You're listening to Intellectual Erection,
a place where we talk about the naughty.
To stimulate your thinking.
You're listening
to
Intellectual Erection.
Intellectual Erection.
Передачу, где мы говорим о диспуте, там субъекты секса.
Hablamos de los sexos.
В компаниях, но мы говорим о
информации.
To stimulate your thinking.
Welcome back to Intellectual Erection with your host, Patrick. And guess who's back on the show? That's right, the charming Professor Lewis. Do you remember Lewis? I think we had a discussion with Lewis, did we not?
We had a lovely discussion.
What did we talk about?
What didn't we talk about?
Good.
Relationships. A lot of relationship stuff
we talked about. We did.
A lot of attitudes towards how I think relationships work for me, how I've developed an approach to this, and what some of my experiences were that led me to kink and open and poly lifestyles.
So this time we'll be kind of picking up where we left off, but more so diving deeper into the definitions of love, sex, pleasure, the body, novelty, fantasies, and these very meaningful concepts that we sometimes just overlook because we find them to be, I don't know, relatively common sense concepts. But are they? I guess we'll find out. Stay tuned for the interview. Before we get to the interview, I just want to mention this will be the last announcement probably for the Intellectual Erection Project panties, because it's happening this coming Saturday, April 20th at Oasis Aqua Lounge. We will be there selling the used panties, as you've seen on the Instagram. The models have worn them in, done some dirty things with those panties, so come out and support the podcast, support the models, support sex workers' rights, as we'll be donating a third of the proceeds to Maggie's Toronto. And other than that, we'll also have some brand new pairs of panties in case you want to buy those. But please come out and support. Just be there, say hi, meet a bunch of us. And then we are going to be back at Oasis again on Wednesday, the 24th of April, for a second sale. That's right. If you can't make it out this Saturday, you better come out on Wednesday. It's going to be so good. I promise you, there's going to be a special show with Zoe Bell, who you met last time on our episode. She'll be doing a squirt performance through a pair of those panties. Lots of exciting stuff. Please make sure to come out. And as always, like, subscribe, review, and most of all, enjoy. So we're back, Lewis and I.
Already started.
Yeah. Talking again. This time, we're going to be talking about love and pleasure and what that means to Lewis and how he envisions, you know, what love and sex and pleasure mean for him, as well as fantasies and his own experiences. And I have a series of questions that I want to get at. We're having some what are we having, bourbon?
Yes,
we're having some nice bourbon together. So this is part of a new series on Intellectual Erection, and the first series was really interviews. I wanted everybody to experience an ethnography of the people involved in these sex-positive communities, to get an idea of who you'll be hearing, their experiences, where they come from, and then I'm going to bring them back, and I'm going to bring you new people, a diverse array of people. And they're going to be telling you about love, sex, pleasure. We're going to be talking about consent. And we're going to get into some very topic-specific things like DDLG, Daddy Dom Little Girl, specific fetishes and kinks, water sports, fisting, anal play, whatever you want to hear. The dirtier, the better. I think, anyway. I felt little horns crawling out of my forehead.
What is dirty? What is dirty?
Exactly.
Apparently, if you're on Tumblr now, dirty is a nipple.
Yeah.
A female presenting nipple. That was the phrase they used.
Presenting?
So I guess, yes. So I guess that's Tumblr's way of being trans-inclusive, perhaps.
What a fucked up way to be trans inclusive. No shit. Trans men? And I noticed a lot of trans men on my Facebook and on Insta are specifically using the opportunity to bare their chests, yep, because now they're weirdly allowed to. Same, yep, nipple.
Yeah.
Right.
But as long as they call themselves or think of themselves or present as a male.
Yeah, present as, yeah.
Then everything's cool. And I think Tumblr is following those kind of lines. And it's...
yeah.
It really, in a very meaningful way, Tumblr was the venue and vehicle through which I discovered a lot of kinks. And it was it was, in a sense, the first community that I kind of found myself associated with, exploring BDSM and DDLG ideas and other kinds of kinks in a way that was very anonymous, in a way that put me in touch with a lot of people with shared interests. None of them happened to be local, but that's, again, part of the beauty of it. But it was all done in a kind of anonymous format that was very, very empowering. Really empowering for somebody who felt a lot of guilt and shame about these things. So it helped me get to a point where I could come out, so to speak.
Right, the anonymity, right, of the virtual platform allowed you that sort of safe space to explore,
yes,
without, you know, having to face the demons just yet.
Right, exactly. All so, right. You know, and that does speak to a lot of the things we wanted to talk about today, right? Like, well, desire.
This is what we're going to get
pleasure
into.
Pleasure and...
Yeah, it's hard not to get tangential with you because you and I think we just... We get along on so many different parallels it's hard not to just talk to you forever. So I might as well just jump into it and start with a heavy hitter.
Right.
So I want to know how you define love, sex, sexuality, and pleasure, and whether or not these are embodied experiences for you, and whether there might or might not be a spiritual dimension to it.
Is there a difference between an embodied experience and a spiritual experience?
For me, there is.
This is kind of one of the things I wonder, is, you know, and I tend to over-intellectualize.
You don't say.
Yeah, go. Surprise.
You don't say, good sir.
It's learning to pay attention to the way my body feels has been one of the most important developments, I think, in my life over the last 10 years or so. And love is most definitely an embodied experience for me. It's most definitely like it. When we say love is a feeling, it really is for me a physical kind of feeling. It's, yeah, a very rare feeling, and I'm very, as you know, really, really particular about the words I want to use. I think our use of vocabulary is important to help us understand the world. That our reality is shaped by the language that we use. Mm-hmm. And so for me, then, choosing the right words to talk about things, love is not a word I toss around very casually. I think I've been in love 3 times in my life. That's it. And every one of those was a moment that I realized. The first, I was so young, I don't think it... I'm not even sure. That might have been like love with training wheels. I'm not sure, mm-hmm, if I ever felt it because wasn't really feeling a lot of things back then because I was in my early 20s. I was really shut down. I was smoking a lot of weed. It was, you know, I hadn't yet figured out who I was and what I was doing with life. With my long-term partner, who is my ex, there was a moment, and I remember it. It was this deep well of laughter and of comfort and of love at a certain point where I'm just laughing and being present with this woman, and it was just like, oh my God, I love you. It really came from deep down in my gut,
guttural,
all the way out through my, right, mouth, through one of those laughters that is a full-bodied laughter, deeply felt laughter, not laughing at, obviously, but just laughing with pure pleasure.
So right? I'm buying it. Yeah, I'm in your story, and I've been there, and I love it, and I know that feeling.
It's out of time. It's a feeling that's really kind of out of time.
I call those eternal moments.
Yeah, interesting. It
find it in my book yet to be published.
Okay, I shall look for it.
The asshole part of me wants to ask the devil's advocate question. What do you say to the scientific, causal determinist, rationalist, pessimist who says something like, yeah, the dopamine center of your body is your gut, and when you experience the thing that we commonly call love, it's really just a rush of dopamine that is observable under microscopic scrutiny in animals. Dogs fall in love with goats, and the feeling can be reciprocated. Okay. And it's that same dopamine rush.
Okay.
I know you can handle this.
What do I say to them?
Yeah, fuck you. Fuck you.
Exactly. I don't fucking care. This doesn't matter to me. The scientific biochemical explanation of it just doesn't matter to me.
Isn't there something about it's not enough of an explanation?
It's
necessary.
It doesn't speak to my experience. Yeah. It's fine. We can find that it's not the cause.
Dare I say that it's the qualia argument that that Nagel brings up about what it's like to be a bat. Like, you can't reduce it to just the biochemical. You can't reduce it to just the behavioral. You can't reduce it because there's something about the quality.
And which comes first? I mean, you can't have that biochemical reaction if the experience isn't there.
Yeah.
If the experience with that person is not present to trigger that reaction. And so it doesn't really matter to me that there's a chemical or biochemical neurological component to this. Fine, absolutely fine. You're telling me the explanation of what's happening to me, not why it's happening to me.
Perfect. I like that. And I think so much of our scrutiny tries to reduce a phenomena to something explicable, finite, minuscule, easy to calculate. And the whole premise of phenomenology is that you really can't. You can't take away the embodied experience. You can't take away the feelings, the memories, that biochemical reaction that you had. But the contextual factors, people remember weird things, colors, the feeling of the grass that you were sitting on, the thickness of the air in that moment.
Absolutely. Like, it doesn't account for how that reaction comes to be.
Yeah.
Right. Where it comes from, why it emerges, it doesn't. And with my current partner, again, it was something very, very similar. And I took a long time, let me own that, before I used the word love with her. And I kind of backed into it. It was like, oh, we've been together almost a year now. We've been dating almost a year. Maybe we should talk about the L word. It was kind of, because I'm very, very reticent, but there's just a feeling I have when I'm with her that is so comfortable. And there's a particular kind of smile she gives me where I see that joy in her face about being with me. And it's something I can't help but reciprocate. It feels so natural and so positive and so affirming and so accepting that it's an absolutely, absolutely wonderful thing. But again, it's not something that comes easily.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something I want to casually toss around. It's I'm not saying I don't want to share it, because I think love has to be shared. It's not something that emerges independently or by oneself. It emerges in a shared sense of energy, a shared sense of commitment, a shared sense of togetherness. But it's not something that happens all the time. It's a very, very rare and precious thing. And that's just the way I feel about it. I know other people that love for them is something easily sort of slipped in and out of. And that's fine. Everybody's mm-hmm. entitled to their own feeling and their own interpretation of their own feelings on this point, for sure. For me, not easy at all. It's hard. Falling in love is hard. Falling out of love is traumatic. Mm. It's traumatic, difficult, exceptionally painful.
Do we have to fall out of love?
That's a good question. I don't know. One of the ways I think about it is I tend to be a bit of a... I'm not sure if it's a cynic. Cynical is the right word. I tend to be somewhat fatalistic about it, in that all relationships end, right? Except for the ones you'll be in the moment you die.
Right.
Right.
Which,
but all relationships,
by default.
Right. And so they end there.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that's where I think we were talking about monogamy, the idea that, and that sort of, I don't know, traditional understanding of monogamy and marriage till death do us part is kind of, that you will be the only person I love from now until the day I die. That's crazy. That's a freaking crazy idea. But again, you know, we fall out of love. Sometimes it happens, you know, it happens for all sorts of reasons. We change, we grow together, we grow apart. And it's not that we necessarily have to do it, I don't think. But if there's the premise that we grow together and grow, like if we can fall in, we can fall out, right?
Right.
Change becomes the only constant.
Okay, so the change, I'm hearing you say that change, not necessarily a fine threshold for an end, might capitulate love, but that change is the measurement by which we are either in or out of love at some point.
Well, we change as people, right? And
yeah.
And we grow. And, you know, with my ex-partner, you know, we both continue to grow in certain ways, and we both kind of, in a way, in my reading of our relationship, inhibited ourselves from growing in other ways. And so while there was love there, and to be honest, I think for me at least, the love never completely disappears, right? Someone who was in my life for so long, who meant so much to me for so long, is always going to mean something to me.
That's what I'm getting at, yeah.
But sometimes I think people casually talk about it. It's like, I love you, but I'm not in love with you. Mm-hmm. And I kind of sympathize or empathize with that.
Yeah.
That position.
I understand,
right?
That too.
Love leaves a residue of feeling that becomes part of who we are, yeah, as a human being. It's part of our experience of the world, and it never, that relationship will never go away. That relationship was a very important,
exactly,
relationship for me for many, many years.
Well, I think you can talk about the in love experience as that dopamine rush, as that feeling of communal belonging, nurturing, that feeling of being with somebody, being accepted and being nurtured. Versus when that person is absent, you are now grieving. But you're grieving because you love. You're grieving because you're missing something that was there for you formerly. And I think one of the most interesting things that I learned from one of my former partners, she told me that, you know, she still loves all of her former partners. And I contested that, but I think part of my grieving process and trying to get over former partners was struggling with the notion of pain because I still love them. I'm not in love in that respective sense, but there's still that love. And it's a recognition of the authenticity of that relationship. And that doesn't go for all my partners. It's not a very, you know, all-encompassing, holistic, everybody gets love. It's, you know, some specific partners left a lasting mark. Other ones have dissipated, like friendships, like a lot of other things.
Mm.
Right? So...
Yeah, it's hard for me to say because I think we do have somewhat of a different attitude or sort of approach to relationships.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I no longer grieve the end of my relationship with my ex. It was a necessary thing, I think, for both of us. Mm-hmm. She might disagree with me, but I think it was necessary for both of us to continue to grow in the ways that we have to grow as individuals. It was important to end that relationship, even though it was very painful and very traumatic. We had to do that. I had to do that for myself.
Yeah.
And I can grieve the loss of that, but I also have to honor the necessity of that, of having to do that for myself, because, you know, perhaps one of the more sticky questions around this is, what is the love that we carry for ourselves? Mm-hmm. And how does that factor into the way we can love other people?
Well, I also wonder, in the aftermath of it all, the type of work that we do, because we are involved, there's some level of agency in how we treat ourselves post love scenario. And my former routine was to treat it as a trauma that gets buried deeper and deeper as a form of sort of repression to try to erase it, because it's painful. And the ways to do that is with anger, hate, and new experiences, flooding yourself with new experiences, erasing the past, forgetting, and reducing your relationship and that person.
There's a short-term solution, isn't it?
I mean, it has worked, but it builds up this like residual anger and this false memory of a person that you once had a very authentic thing with.
Absolutely.
You don't spend 5-6 years with somebody that you didn't care about.
Well, that's what I mean. It's an injustice. It's a short-term solution.
Yeah.
It sounds more like a coping mechanism.
It is. It was.
And those are good. Like, again, I had a therapist that would tell me, dude, you got to honor your coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
Because your coping mechanisms help you cope through very difficult periods of your life. And anything that can help you survive a difficult period in your life is something that's valuable. That doesn't mean you need to stay there. As a matter of fact, you need to kind of cope, use the short term to get to a place where you can adequately process all of that stuff. But we have to process those painful experiences. Otherwise, we don't grow out of them.
Mm-hmm.
They just sit there and
fester
and take energy away from us that could be better spent developing new ideas and new relationships. You know, it's hard to develop new love for somebody when you're holding on to the anger and grief about.
Well, I also see with what I've learned in polyamory is the overlap. If you're able to love more than one person simultaneously, and if you've opened yourself up to that experience, then that can be a learning tool for that grieving process of losing somebody and having that overlap with a new partner who you should ideally ought to treat with, you know, their own respect and their own affordability for love without that overlap compromising that. It obviously doesn't work out perfectly, but at least that mentality allows you to think about it in a way that doesn't demand certainty and perfection.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you have to have ended this relationship. You have to be out of love. You have to have had a refractory period and then get into a new relationship, restart the whole process again, as laborious and tedious as that seems, reformulate a bond, and then engage in another relationship that, like you said, is bound to end either by default or by circumstance. I see what you're saying.
I think then it's like, do you give yourself an opportunity when a loving relationship ends, do you give yourself an opportunity to grieve that before you get into other relationships that you might call loving? Or do you...
That self-love? That
Or with other people. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I try to, because obviously I'm going to be affected by it and so are my behaviors, and I don't really want to dump that on another person. But if you're in a poly relationship, then you can't really get out of that. If you have simultaneous partners, you lose one, then the partner you have is going to have to bear the burden of you know, supporting you if they want to and if you allow them.
It was interesting. When I met my current partner, right around the same time, I'm not sure if I talked about this in our previous chat, I met somebody right around, another person right around the same time, and that relationship was a very DS relationship. The dynamic was kind of fucked up, but I really came to care about this woman. I really did care about her,
I think you did mention a little bit.
I don't think I was caring about her for the right reasons. I think it became kind of codependent.
Mm-hmm.
But I did really, really care. I'm not sure if I really loved her or not, but nevertheless, the end of that relationship was very wrenching, very, very, very wrenching, and I had to make a real choice about what I want to do for myself. And you know, she wanted me to be monogamous, and that was always one of those situations where it's like, and I have this other relationship with my current partner where it was open and we were happy about being open. And it was really wrenching because this woman was really triggering me in a lot of ways that were making me want to take care of her awful codependent bullshit.
Was this the same person that was asking you to smoke weed and fuck?
Yeah. That was her.
We talked about it a little bit. Yeah.
But what was so interesting is, you know, I don't know if I mentioned that when I did kind of finally make the break, it was really wrenching. I cried deeply in a way that I hadn't in years and years and years. It was very kind of cathartic. But I was massively shook. And I called the woman's my current partner. I said, can you meet for a drink? And she thought I was going to break up with her. She actually thought I was going to break up with her and go, and because that had happened to her before with other partners. And she kind of supported me through the whole process of me dealing with my emotions of hurt and pain and loss that came with ending that other toxic relationship, right?
Right.
And it was an incredibly affirming moment that made me realize, holy shit, this is what love is. Like trying to rationally understand it, feeling it is one thing. There's also a level of rational understanding of an analysis, obviously. What is this? What does it mean? And what kind of responsibilities does loving confer or demand from us? And I think that experience helped us grow and helped our love develop to another level. And it was pretty soon after that, I think, we started actually using the L word.
So what I'm hearing is that, which is, I don't know if it's common sense or if it's just psychologically true, is that adversity shared between people forms bonding experiences. You think of fraternity in war, and I say fraternity because most wars were fought by mostly men, not always. The building of the bond that comes through adversity, I think, is a narrative trope, if nothing else. And you're tying it in now to love. So it's a bit of a challenge to what I said formerly is, I said, you know, maybe the rebound idea of what people typically think of as a rebound, putting your former relationship onto your new partner or using somebody else to get out of a former relationship, which gets messy in poly situations, for you became a bonding experience. Maybe you weren't both suffering the same ordeal, but that somebody was supportive for you during that time created a bond.
Right, right.
That allowed express vulnerability from you, a feeling of support, and the absence of maybe embarrassment and being judged unfairly.
Being judged, period.
Being judged, period.
Right.
Right? So non-judgmental acceptance, allowing you to emotionally vent and express, and being there for you can be extremely, extraordinarily powerful.
Absolutely. And it's hard to accept sometimes. It's hard to, for me, it's hard to accept that.
Yeah.
It's a difficult, because there's a lot of questions of self-esteem, of self-worth.
Naturally.
Am I worthy of this? And, you know, having some childhood trauma around these kinds of questions, it makes it hard to accept that kind of help and support and love. And it's difficult. And learning how to accept that from somebody is, again, was part of what the process that helped me learn to love myself and love properly, so to speak, other people. It's a fascinating process, and I'm still figuring out. And your use of the idea of fraternal love, the example in you know, soldiers in wartime, so to speak, has me thinking about, and it's something I still have to kind of, I think, sort through. Love in terms of friendships, mm-hmm. and what that means to me too, right? It's love is a weird word, I think, especially for a lot of cishet guys, who, especially like me growing up in the 70s and 80s, love was not a word you ever used to describe the relationship that we had with each other. And it's interesting, only now are there a few friends of mine,
yeah,
who've been able to say these words, and I've been able to say these words too. And it's fascinating that the older we get as men, it's becoming more important for us to actually.
Doesn't it feel fucking great?
It really does. It really does.
I mean, all the men in my life now that are good friends, we do say we love each other. And it's not, I mean, it's become a social phenomenon because of bromance, which was, you know, it's a social media you know, rom-com sort of thing, but it's become a reality. I have a friend of mine, a really good friend I've known for 17 years, and we often declare our love for each other, which is that platonic love that's talked about in the symposium, and it's a true bond.
It's also, I think, how, you know, especially again for cishet guys, the way in which love gets wrapped around the idea of sex. If you're not having sex with somebody, it can't be love.
Well, that's the follow-up. I was waiting, but see, with you it's really hard to get into new questions because we have a lot to talk about. That was the wrench I was going to throw in there, is like, okay, where does pleasure come into love? Is it intimately tied in with love? And is there a distinction between the pleasure one feels in the company of a good friend, sharing the bond of friendship over something like bourbon that we're doing now, versus the sexual pleasure and stimulation of genitalia, which in the BDSM and kink community is also obscured and obfuscated by the oddities of playing with toys and playing in the absence of genital stimulation. So there's mental stimulation, there's tactile response, there's non-tactile response. Now we get messy.
What is sex? That was one of the questions we wanted to talk about a little earlier. Because in BDSM communities, you can have full-on sex and never take your clothes off.
That happens.
It happens all the time. It happens all the time.
People get mind-fucked, body-fucked. You know, I guess some people get spiritually fucked.
Well, my partner, we have this cute little ongoing joke. It was probably one of the first or second times we were fooling around right after we met. We fooled around pretty much straight away. We didn't fuck the first date, but we did most other stuff. And I think the second date she was like, well, we need to have sex. And I was, well, you know, we had sex last time we were together. You were riding my face. Remember that? And she's just, oh, come on. You know what I mean. And it's like, what? You mean penis and vagina sex? Is that sex? We were kind of joking about it because, you know, she doesn't believe that that's the be-all and end-all of sex either by any stretch of the imagination.
It's not.
But it tends to be, again, the way our language tends to reflect a particular idea of what sex is. That, you know, for me, sex can be something I do over text. It can be something I do, again, swapping a couple of photos. It can be something very anticipatory. It can be fully clothed. It can be completely naked. It's,
well, according to Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr, you know, it's the definitions of sex are very broad.
Female presenting titties.
That and suggestive sex, suggestive items and posts, which I'm great that they acknowledge are sexual. And I'm grateful that they...
It's kind of interesting, isn't
it? Yeah, I'm like, good, you're acknowledging that there's sexuality present in this and that it, that it's promoting that, but you stopping it is absurd.
Well, it's also reducing all sex to pornography, which is all, or all visual representations of sex to pornography,
and it's
which
is that, fucking ridiculous. And I'm reminded of that prudish North American, the puritanical North American divide versus Europe, the more sexually forward, expressive, body positive.
Dude, when I was in Europe in like 19, oh, I forget how, when it was. I
guns
was like
are okay.
20, 21 years old. I was in this little Greek island, this lovely Greek island that was, I was like, I think the only North American hanging out at this campsite. The beach was a totally nude beach, and I was still really, you know, I think I was 20 or 21, and I'm really kind of like shy about my body, and we would go out to the beach, and I was literally, this was this situation, I'm the only person with any type of clothing on, and I felt ridiculous. It was the first kind of conscious moment where I was like, yeah, this has nothing to do with sexuality. The body has nothing, the nude body has nothing to do with sexuality. Unclothed body has nothing to do with sexuality.
It's human.
It was lovely, and it was a very, again, at like 20, 21 years old, that was like a mind-blowing experience for me, because I'd never felt that. I'd never experienced that growing up in Toronto, which is the culture here is very, very puritanical. It's very old school Protestant. Even though it's an incredibly diverse city, there's a deeply rooted sort of WASP culture, you know, puritanical Protestant culture in this city.
And the oddities of things we elect to shame normatively versus the things that are more harmful, right? I mean, this is not news. This is not mind-blowing information that sex and sexuality, sure, it can have harmful, risky side effects, and it can be used divisively against people and populations, and it has been. However, the acceptance of violence, arms as in weapons, and, you know, borders and restrictions and imprisonment and all these forms of physical suffering that we glorify, employ, witness in media, find as forms of entertainment in films. These things are present, available, glorified, accepted, yet a fucking nipple is a problem.
Right. It's
when the fuck did a nipple ever hurt you?
I got poked in the eye once. No, I'm just totally lying about that.
Right, but
that's about the worst that I'm gonna get out of it.
Or
you know, somebody's pierced nipple is gonna get caught on something. Anyway, this
mine
is all silly.
It's ridiculous.
But it raises some interesting questions. I think one of the other things you asked a little earlier was like that relationship between sex and pleasure.
Yeah.
And is sex always pleasurable?
No, I don't think so.
I don't know. It's something I really wonder. Sex is a very, very pleasurable activity for me. Don't get me wrong. And sex and love, and the relationship between sex and love is actually, I have to say, is a far more complicated for me than I ever thought it would be.
Right.
A really interesting thing, actually, oddly enough, I have my partner and I have a couple friend of ours, also open, kinky, out there. They do amazing things. Have a wonderful relationship. Their relationship is, you know, he came over to talk to us because that couple's having problems around their sexuality and their sexual connection between each other. And it's almost like the more, and it's something I notice, I know about myself, and something I have to really, really catch about myself. The more connected I am with somebody, the more I love somebody, it changes, the sex changes. And it changes in some, what are becoming to me actually kind of almost predictable sort of ways. I'm starting to realize some of the patterns I have around this. When I don't have a connection with somebody, the sex can be very, very free, very easy. It can go all over the place. It can develop in all sorts of different dynamics, and there's very little stake involved in it. Stakes involved in it, right? When I'm with someone that I love, things change, and the stakes are way higher. So my partner, you know, when we started playing, we were very experimental. Like we still experiment. We do different things. Like, you know, we're very exhibitionist. We like to play in groups. But for instance, DS play was something we did a lot more when we were new as a couple. Now it's something really, really, really difficult for me. And she's kind of asking me for this. She's wanting this in the relationship. Why can't you top me the way you used to? And it's like, well, because for the last 3 years I've been hearing you talk about how awful toxic masculinity is and how difficult it is to deal with power and men. And it's like, yeah, but I trust you. Why can't you do this for me? And part of it is it would be too simple to say that I'm not really about, you know, I don't want to put it on her and say all this stuff she told me is making me fearful about doing that. She's asking, so why can't I provide this? And so there's something in me that I have to kind of, why can't I provide this? Why can't I be free in with her in the way that I used to be? Is there something about love, this deep, deep emotional connection that kind of constrains me somewhat in how I approach our sexuality? It's a challenge. It's something I'm trying to think through and work through right now. I don't really have an answer for it. I'm aware of the issue, and it was what was really interesting was my friend and his partner, they're having kind of what sounded to us like a really similar question, a really similar issue in their relationship. They love each other in ways that they've never loved any other person before, and the vulnerability that entails and how that impacts their sexual connection. It's a fascinating, fascinating thing. And it's, I'm trying, and I think the more we bring it into the light, the more we kind of talk about these kinds of dynamics, the more we confront together, the easier it's getting to kind of, this will be the next level for us to get to in our sexual relationship, mm-hmm. right? Is it bring like love and all that early freedom that we kind of had back together again.
It's just, I think what you're getting at is there's a sense of difficulty in performing in front of somebody who knows you really well, because that performativity is transparent. They know you so well that when the performance is laid on, it's seen as an act. Whereas in the novel relationship, in the fresh, unpredicted sex act, you can always act the dom, and right. It's not seen through, because whether or not it's seen as a performance doesn't matter, because there's no behind the stage. It's right. Like meeting your idol. It's like meeting that band that you love. It's once you've seen them naked, once you've seen them behind the stage, once you've seen them as people, their performance becomes a little bit transparent.
Right. The other thing, though, the flip side of that is that even though a lot of our sexuality isn't perhaps as elaborate or as performative as it used to be, the pleasure involved in it is still at a level that novel sex, so to speak, mm-hmm. can't ever get to. I mean. Yeah. I can sit. I don't want to say it's tantric or anything like that, because I've never practiced that. I've never studied it, but I can sit in with very few movements and enjoy the feeling of being inside her. That is just
oh my god!
And the orgasms are so much fucking better than they would be just tossing one off with somebody new.
Yeah,
because there's so much comfort and familiarity and trust and vulnerability that it just makes everything so much more intense. It's incredibly intense. But part of the problem, part of the difficulty is that it can be so easy just to stay in that kind of intensity and like it for what that is, and lose some of the other fun things that made sex so that makes sex so much fun, right? So it's like, how do we how do we have both? You know what I mean?
Well, that's the thing about being, I think, in the poly community is you're not supposed to have, not that you're not supposed to, sorry, you're not forced to try to have that with one partner, because novelty by definition has to be new,
right?
And that is something that you can only experience with a new partner. But novelty by its definition dies after it's experienced,
right?
So every time you experience a new partner, it's done with that experience. That's something that is highly stimulating for its novelty diminishes with the experience, and you can only have that once. Beyond that, there is what people refer to as chemistry, is that bond.
Absolutely.
It's
absolutely.
That relational tie, because you're both interested in maybe being pleasured or pleasuring each other in the same ways, which formulates something that becomes more comfortable.
Right.
As you said, being inside a person can be extremely rewarding in that bonding, non-judgmental, being okay to be vulnerable experience, where you're not worried about your body, how it looks, who's looking at you. You don't have that they-ness in the room, that gaze, right? You're able to lose yourself in the experience, and then you truly feel your cock enveloped in this pleasurable experience that proceeds from the genitals into your body, and it's like seeping through your veins, and your whole body's just ecstatic.
Yeah, it's, talk about a bodily love.
Yeah, and your mind's into it, which is not separate from your body in the way I think about it. And
Well, and a lot of just sort of novel sex tends to be very just dick focused a lot of times.
Yeah,
it doesn't always have to be, but I mean, when you're fucking someone for that you're just kind of like having a casual relationship, is great. I mean, and dick focused sex, or you know, vag focused sex, I don't want to, again, to speak for women, it's great, it's fun. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it, then I love the novel, don't get me wrong. Yeah. I fucking love the novel, but you know, the stakes are so different, and it's so fascinating.
Absolutely.
Any other questions? We've been talking
for I do have one more thing. It might help for you if you close your eyes and relate a first person experience as though you're in the moment. You can either talk about a fantasy you'd like to have. You're going to tell me a story. You're going to tell me a story, but that story can either be fictional, it could be realistic, it could be something that happened to you, or it could be something that you wish to happen to you. And I'd like you not to say which one it is.
Okay, I won't. I know the story. Traveling in Europe, I'm on a train with one of my best friends, one of my oldest friends, and this other woman we were traveling with. And we got to this one station. It's like, we're in Germany, and it's in the middle of the night. And all of a sudden, all these, like, again, I'm early 20s, all these other sort of like early 20s folks just kind of just rammed onto the train at this one station. And what went from being a very sort of empty and casual train ride became a very, very crowded and busy environment. And this woman came in, all of a sudden the cabin we were in, which is like, you know, three seats, the seats pulled out so you can kind of sleep on them. We'd already pulled them out and we're already lying down, and these other people came in, and one of them was this woman. She just kind of came in and laid down next to me. And within like 10 or 15 minutes, we're making out, and we've got each other's pants down, and we're just completely going at it. And people are walking by on the train. My friend's like, dude, are you okay? It's like, I'm like, fuck. Everything's really, really good right now. And it was, I think it was the first time I ever realized I'm an exhibitionist, because people are walking up and down the train. He's telling me, people are like looking in and watching you, like, guys have sex. It's like, I had to pull the curtains back. I'm like, I don't fucking care, man. Nobody knows who I am.
This was in Germany?
This was in Germany.
I'm sure the Germans have a long-ass word for fucking on a train while being watched by others in motion.
With a total stranger.
With a total stranger.
Yeah, absolutely. There has to be one single German word.
Right? Yeah, it's in there somewhere.
But it was just, again, we were totally going at it. I didn't know. I literally hadn't spoken a word to her. And it was just this encounter that was purely random, purely mutual, purely consensual.
That is so fucking hot. We were
obviously both into it.
Yeah.
And I ended up, she's like, why don't, afterwards, we talked afterwards. It's like, why don't you come with me? I'm going to see friends in Bonn. Why don't you come? We're going to a party. So I'm like, yeah, okay. I'll go with you.
All right.
And then, like, you know, 24 hours later, I'm at this party in Bonn. I with nobody I know, because how the fuck do you get there? You're just like, eh, whatever. It was great.
That's an adventure.
That was a good. That's and that's a kind of, again, that's like a, is that a fantasy? Is that real?
You know, it's an experience worth writing about, is what that is.
It indeed, or talking about.
And that's what we're doing, and that's what we've done, and that's what we're gonna keep on doing, because that's what this is about. And I hope your perky, horny ears are satisfied. You dirty, smut-loving perverts out there.
You're all so dirty, dirty, dirty.
And even you prudish ones that are listening in and pretending.
Oh, you're dirty too. You're dirty too. You just have to embrace it.
You know, I looked on SoundCloud and there's priests and ministers and churches listening to this podcast.
Seriously?
I swear to God. I'm like, these guys are fishing for material so they can bring it up in their sermon and be like, this is the devil's work.
You know, ideally, they're going to be sitting there with, like, you know, a flogger.
Yeah, self-flagellating while they masturbate listen. And I'm say, such a terrible dear devil. God, I wish I was part of this.
This awful. Oh, oh, it's awful. Whip. Oh, oh, this is so terrible. Awful. As they writhe in painful pleasure.
All right. Until next time.
Until next time.
Lewis.
We had a lot more to talk
there's
about.
Gonna be, there's only definitely going to be a next time. Good, there's so much to talk about.
I love it.
It absolutely never ends.
And that's part of the beauty of it all, right?
Never satisfied, consistently thriving.
There you go. Cheers, man.
Cheerio.
You're listening to Intellectual Erection, a place where we talk about the naughty to stimulate your thinking.